Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And we are back.
We are back.
It feels good to be back. I hate this. I hate taking breaks, but I need breaks.
Yes.
So, I mean, during the break, all this, like this happened the last time when we took a break. And then all these things started to go wrong in the break that was applicable to the show. And I was like, we need to be able to do this. And by the time we get back to it, it's going to be over. And then we're going to be in a different news cycle. In this case, you know, we had the Catholic Church. We had, it was crazy.
It was popping off.
And we couldn't get anything to you. So it's good to be back behind these mics.
Yes.
So first off, we want to thank Kalika Dennis, who threw some coins in the collection plate right as we would take. That was another thing that happened during the break. She took care of us during the break, like we weren't even putting out any content, and she dropped us some something real nice.
Thank you
Kalika. And then I also noticed that we got another review during the break, 5 stars to balance out that raggedy 1 star that we got after the queer theology episode. But we got 5 stars from Doug Rice. Doug Rice is a Twitter super fan. I just appreciate, you know, how much he loves the show and kind of pushes us on Twitter. On iTunes, he actually reviewed us. He said, "I started listening to Faith Uncut about 6 months ago, and it quickly became one of my favorite podcasts." That's awesome. "The host strike the perfect balance of honoring the Christian tradition and calling out the ways in which it's problematic. If you're into conversations on theology, religion, and social issues, you should definitely add this one to your list." It's really amazing, y'all.
Thanks, Doug.
That is so awesome.
Yeah, that's a great review.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Doug. I just felt great. I was like, yeah, we got to get back now. We got to get back moving.
We're motivated.
All right, so during the break, I got a question from a fan of the show, Mark, who was also on the show when we had I can't remember what we called that, but... Mark was showing a lot of love to the show, and we decided to bring a fan onto the show. And he asked me this question during the break because I had announced that I was returning to seminary. And so I started seminary this month. And he asked, "Why did a self-proclaimed heretic enroll in seminary?" Now, I know Mark, so this wasn't like what it sounds like. Mm-hmm. It's just like, because he knows me, so he knows that on the show, you know, I am a heretic and I embrace that. That's not a problem. That just means I'm countercultural, counter-church cultural, which is fine with me. But why did I go back to seminary? Mm-hmm. It is because it's always been a goal of mine to finish. I wanted to do this. And so seminary is kind of that place, that Bible study that you can ask the questions that you may not get answered in your own Bible study at your church. So like, I can actually sit there in an academic environment and learn from other people, other cultures, other traditions, and you just talk to people, bounce ideas off, you know, professors, people who have been doing this for a living, for a lifetime. And it's just a good environment for me to be in, because it ultimately also serves some long-term goals I have. But I was like, okay, let's do this. I want to get back in.
Yes, that's great.
I actually got hooked up with Jazz Hands from the Brown Liquor Report. Hooked me up with Associate Dean at Wesley Theological Seminary, and we had a great discussion. Great enough. Like, after that discussion, I was like, all right, let me open up a web browser and see what I can do. And it actually worked out, because I was between two schools at the time, and he actually convinced me. So I'm back.
Congratulations.
And thank you. So I will be in between assignments and classes, I'm still here bringing you more Faith Uncut. All right, so we also announced at the end of last season that we were going back to church. So, did you go?
So, yes, I went. Okay, so yes, in a nutshell, yes, I did go to church.
Okay. So, but what made you decide to go back to church?
I missed it.
Okay.
I just missed the Sunday morning event of going to church, and also the camaraderie that you find there. There's even camaraderie and a little bit of the confusion. Let me clarify that. You know, just because you question certain aspects of the organization or certain aspects of the delivery of the information doesn't discount that there are also good things there.
Right.
So I think that to be there with people who have a sincere you know, inquisitiveness about how, what church is, how it's supposed to function, what they're supposed to get from the message and what they're supposed to get from each other. I think that that's a healthy energy to be there, because hopefully all things working together, you get those questions answered. So yes, I went to church. I was in New York with my family, but I have not been to my church locally that you know, usually go to. Not yet. I haven't counted it out, but I haven't done it yet.
So how was it? Were the things that you were looking for?
I had a great time. And again, this is not like going to a concert, but I left there calm and peaceful. So I didn't leave there, you know, feeling assaulted. I didn't leave there feeling empty. I didn't leave there angry at all. I actually enjoyed the service and enjoyed the sermon, so I had a good time.
Okay. Yeah, I decided to go back, and I started this podcast as I was leaving a church, and just to work some things out for myself. And I actually did need to do that work apart from my church family, because it was a waste of time for me to be there in the state that I was in, where I have these questions and I'm like, that's not quite right.
Right.
And that's, I don't know why we're doing that, but not having a theology formed for myself. And so it's okay to have the questions, but to do the work to answer those questions and actually create something that matters. And so I actually worked with a friend of mine, Reverend Brandy Jasmine Mitzrahim from Kansas.
Okay.
AME pastor who was a consultant and actually helped me build or form that theology. So she took the randomness that I had and challenged me to put some structure to it.
Ooh, okay.
And so it was good. I had a whole syllabus and I had to go through this material and actually put something together. Mm-hmm. And I'm still working through it, but I got to a point where I was like, this makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
This theology works where nothing worked before and is wholly different from anything that I knew was going on in any churches, at least in this immediate vicinity.
Mm-hmm.
But I was okay going back because I'm like, I feel healthy now. Like, I feel I believe differently than, you know, this family, but that's okay. It's the way that my theology is structured. It doesn't matter. It doesn't require that I believe everything the same way, because we can work together to do the things that God would want us to do here to help people, to help communities and things like that. Like, we can do that together. So once I was healthy enough to go back, I was like, all right, let's do it.
Yeah, I think I can relate to just stepping away for a moment and doing the personal development work, because I did not feel adversarial. I did not feel controversial in that moment. I felt like I was grounded for where my journey had taken me to. And I was able to not have to look for points of conflict or, you know, anticipate conflict from just going to a church service. So that felt very, very freeing, because it let me know that the growth was happening even if I wasn't, you know, monitoring certain things. So me being outside of the structure of going to church every Sunday or whatever it was did not mean that I had somehow estranged myself from, I don't know, a faith belief. If anything, I was trying to strengthen it and anchor it more so for my understanding. You know, I remember being at a church service when I was younger, at my home church, small church in DC, where that particular sermon, our pastor said, you cannot be a Christian just because your mom is one or because your family is one. He was like, you're going to come to a point where you're going to have to know what you know for yourself. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that's what the journey has been. And now I'm adding things back because I know what I know. I know how I feel. And I'm open to growing more and anchoring deeper in the intellectual and academic side of certain things.
Yeah, I think that's a healthy way to be. And I will say, for anyone else who's considering going back, I didn't just go back to the same church that I left. I mean, I ended up doing that, but it was strategic in that when I decided I could go back to church, any church, I had to look at the churches available to me and see which church does the least harm. Like, I'm not gonna, believe everything that they believe here, but I'm also not gonna put myself in a position where I'm like, nah, I can't invite, you know, my queer friends to this church, or I know how this church views women, and I'm not gonna sit there and listen to that. Like, I had to assess which churches theologically did the least harm, even though they didn't, you know, we didn't align theologically. And so that it ended up being the church that I left, which was a good church when I left it. It wasn't the church that was a problem. It was me, you know, trying to work out some stuff. So I'm back, and we'll be updating you so you can see how it goes. Yes. Speaking of church, there was a statement released, I guess about 2 weeks ago now, it was signed by John MacArthur of Grace Community Church. And John MacArthur, as some people know, is the author of many books and biblical commentaries. I remember starting a collection of John MacArthur commentaries, started with the book of Acts, and you had to buy these one at a time. It was like one book per book of the Bible. So he led a group of over 7,000 signatories on this statement on social justice and the gospel. All right, this statement is a collection of affirmations and denials of Christians on various social issues, like gender roles and same-sex relationships and social justice. And it's basically a series of statements, I guess, suggesting what we should affirm or deny about the faith. So they talk about the Bible, or scripture, God, and, as the statement implies, social justice.
Right. Okay. So here's the part where you have to understand that the statement is written from the standpoint that social justice, from this writer's standpoint, he sees this newfound enthusiasm for social justice as a threat to the Christian church.
Yes.
In his assessment, which is extremely self-centered, and you know, sometimes we can't see the forest for the trees, but he has been able to garner 7,000 signatures, some by church leaders, some by higher ranking leadership, and presumably some by just supporters, people who believe the same statements, that this is an affirmation that social justice is somehow the enemy of traditional Christianity.
He says it's taking us away from what the gospel is about. It's a distraction.
And to that we say?
It's bullshit. So this is the, well, you already gonna see the E on this episode, because I'm not gonna be able to hold back on this one, because this one kind of worked me up. All right, so one of the statements is, we deny that political or social activism should be viewed as integral components of the gospel or primary to the mission of the church. We deny that it should be viewed as primary or integral. That is a odd statement. That is, reading the gospel, that is a odd statement.
Yeah, it is.
All right, so there's others.
There are others.
We deny that any person is morally culpable for another person's sin. So that translates to me, we white people are not are not responsible for the sins of our fathers
currently.
Because the statement's about social justice, and social justice is about white supremacy and racism in America. Mm-hmm. So he's saying we did not do it.
I don't mean to crack up like this, but it's just like, how much trash can you compact into one offering, one literary offering? It's a lot of trash.
They went for the record. Yeah.
It's a lot of trash here.
What else we got?
Okay, so we also further deny that one's ethnicity establishes any necessary connection to any particular sin. That is rather convenient, because when we talk about a westernized world and an American style or a Western style of Christianity that is primarily based on the lens of whiteness on those religious reflections and those religious acts. So this is disingenuous. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And to be clear,
white
supremacy impacts everyone, not just black people.
Man, it impacts white people too.
White people too.
And white people are seeing it, and people of color are like stepping to the side, like, "Hey, that's your jam, but it's okay. Like, we're good. We're gonna get through it together. But we ain't finna lie about nothing." We reject any teaching that encourages racial groups to view themselves as privileged oppressors or entitled victims of oppression.
There's no such thing as white privilege, and you are not oppressed simply because you're black.
Ooh, child, the lies. Okay. We deny that a person's feelings of offense or oppression necessarily prove that someone else is guilty of sinful behaviors, oppression, or prejudice.
You feel like you're being oppressed, but you really aren't. There's your gaslight statement right there.
Ooh.
You feel like it, but that doesn't
mean somebody
did it.
And keep in mind that this statement is written. This statement comes to light after the examples of cruelty to migrants at the border, cruelty to children who happen to travel to the border with an adult or with their parents. They have been separated. This statement comes out at least 2 months after, you know, people are responding in the heat and in the passion of the example of families being separated at different points of entry. So this statement comes after, you know, these years long protests and battles about unarmed police shootings, mm-hmm. or police shooting unarmed people who overwhelmingly are people of color. I feel like other shootings get obscured because in ignoring the problem, you end up ignoring victims who actually have a lot in common with what you think the majority is. So there are white men who have been unarmed, who have been killed by police, but we cannot begin to talk about that because at no point do certain entities want to talk about the violence against people of color, which sometimes is concentrated and amplified in areas where they occur in very, very large numbers. So you might not want to talk about, you know, there was a shooting in rural Louisiana of a Caucasian man. He was in the car with his son, and he was killed by two police officers who were indicted and who may have gone to trial by now. But the point is, they at least got an indictment for that. But you're not going to see that shooting juxtaposed with Alton Sterling, because I'd rather not discuss either of them to keep from giving rise to something like Sterling. This statement comes out as the Me Too movement continues to evolve. Mm-hmm. This statement is being amplified as we are calling our current administration to the carpet on whether or not it is propped up on white supremacy. Now, anecdotally, we can say, you know, quickly, yes, it is, or, you know, here are the examples, but we are actively trying to challenge this effort to mainstream certain aspects of white supremacy that people are saying, oh, I'm taking my voice back because I don't want to be handcuffed by being politically correct. You just want to be a racist, and you don't want nobody to say nothing to you about it. So this statement, you know, however well intended, is so extremely tone deaf and obtuse in this flow of the conversation, because this to me sounds like profound resistance. Like, this right here is like a perm that ain't gonna take.
And we're inside 60 days of oppression season, i.e.
these midterm elections,
where voter suppression is a real thing based on color.
Race. Oh my gosh.
So, all right. So here's my issue with this statement. Actually, I don't know if it's with the statement. This statement exasperates an existing issue.
Mm-hmm.
That issue is white American Christians
mm-hmm.
continually refuse to acknowledge the harm that they and their theology has inflicted on the American citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So we have Puritans who come over, and now we've had shows touching on these topics in more detail.
Yes.
So
this the cliff notes.
Right. So Puritans come over, bring their Queen Victorian culture. Mm-hmm. And we have Manifest Destiny that entitles people to land that is not theirs. And so mm-hmm. we have a genocide of a native population
of millions of people.
Right. So basically the choices that those natives were given were, hey, you can convert
or you can die.
Okay. convert to a Christian theology.
Convert to a Christian theology and take your place at the bottom of the totem pole of the society that we intend for this theology to lord over. So let's dial it back. Cliff Notes. This country is established by European immigrants who are escaping monarchies and escaping the emergence of governmental systems that will not serve them. So the ideals that we hold clear and hold true in what eventually became our Declaration of Independence and our Bill of Rights, which eventually became our Constitution, is that we are or should be allowed to live free of tyranny. Okay. Mm-hmm. One of the tyrannies of the monarchy or tyrannies of the king or of the monarchy of England was that you could not speak out against the king. You mm-hmm. could not speak out against the parliament. You had to worship in the Anglican church. And at the time, if you're not a history buff, you got to understand that people were dying whether or not they were Protestant or Catholic. So it was not as calm as it is now. Any churches leaving the Catholic Church, sects leaving the Catholic Church, was threatening to the Catholic Church, because by that time the Catholic Church was a business. It was superimposed over the previous Roman Empire. So quick and dirty, our first immigrants here are running, fleeing from institutions that are trying to take their freedoms. Here you're able to establish different Christian churches to worship as you please. Our freedom of religion is also freedom from it. We are coming very, very dangerously close to people misinterpreting that particular amendment, that we, or that particular ideal, that we do have freedom of religion here, which means worship as you please. You are also free to not do it.
Right.
A lot of people do not understand that, you know, your rights end where my nose begins. This is how I learned it in like a political science history class. So you are free to worship. Okay. I am free to not worship. Where we intersect is where we then have to negotiate whose rights supersede whomever else's. So we see these questions in certain ways. We see it when, okay, so like right now, this particular statement is basically trying to, the term that came to mind was whitewash, but I don't want to be.
They're just trying to absolve themselves of the crime have not admitted still.
At all. So it's kind of like, and it's triggering because right now you do have marginalized groups speaking up and trying and attempting to articulate to the state or to the church or to their communities that these policies, these actions, these standards are harming the individual, the child, the community. Statements like this make it seem like not only do we not hear you, but we will never respond in the way that is most meaningful mm-hmm. to you.
They want to say so badly, we didn't do it.
But you benefit from it.
And also your denial of the current effects of that means you're still doing it.
You
know you're doing it. You're saying we didn't do it, but we're going to perpetuate the system. We're going to keep this machine going. We're not going to, and when we get in the voting booth, we're going to keep it going. When it's our turn to vote for someone, we're going to vote for someone who is going to pull children away from their parents at the border. We're going to vote for someone who is going to take away rights from women.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to vote for someone who is going to make sure that you can't vote based on race.
Mm-hmm.
You're still
with surgical precision, surgical precision. And yes, we are 60 days outside of the midterms. And yes, you know, we cannot separate a statement like this from the political authority and energy that is saying that we need to energize this portion of our voting base. We need to affirm these things, that basically the actions that this administration might be taking, which they think are veiled attempts at securing an American culture, an American quality or way of life, they are actually the pillars of white supremacy. So if I guard the borders, if I control the schools, if I gut certain protection laws, if I make it hard for my authority to be reined in, you will wake up in a state that you don't recognize. right? So I've always been concerned about the Constitution, one, because it's flammable, and two, because it's an idea, right? So when we're starting to see the effects of what happens when people cut off their logic and their common sense because their emotions are not prepared to deal with the reality of somebody else's truth. This to me sounds like somebody who's like, emotionally, I just can't handle being this guilty. I can't handle the fact that you've laid out a strong case for me that Christian churches and people who identify as Christians could be doing more to help the least of us, more to help the poor, more to help people who do not have security in housing and health care, more to help people who need assistance with assimilating to America. You know, if you come here and you don't speak a language, that's not the time to say go home. If the person is really coming and wants to be, and wants to contribute, or has a right, a human right, to live in a place where they are safe. But that is something that we try to tell people all the time. Americans don't even have that all the time. And it's not that we don't have it because we're not fighting for it. We don't have it because it gets to a point where somebody don't want you to have it.
So the challenge for me is I'm growing up, as I said, you know, I read MacArthur books and I read, you know, books from these leaders who now I'm able to see mm-hmm. those colors. And I start to see, and I'm thinking back, and I see all of this time where, you know, the teaching is more like, okay, we're God's people. Mm-hmm. We're basically the children of Israel, and I'm like, well, okay, so the gatekeepers of this theology for millennia have been white people, European theologians, and people like the way it works, the way the system works, you know, you get a group of people who starts to write some things, and then they quote some other people who are like them, and then mm-hmm. you start to have professors who are like them, and mm-hmm. they're quoting those writers like them and those books and so that's how you build a system where voices are drowned out.
Yep.
And so this theology has been guided for all of this time by people who have attempted to cast themselves in the role of Israel, mm-hmm. biblical Israel. And so I'm thinking, I'm like, well, Israel, the story of Israel is a people who were building a nation like out of nothing. Like, this is God building them out of nothing, and this is how they interact with God. And they started off with no land, and they had to find their plot, and you know, they were enslaved, and it's the story of an oppressed people. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at the people, the gatekeepers of this theology, and I'm like, when have you been oppressed? Like, how do you identify with that group of people? How do you have the audacity to cast yourself in the role of the oppressed when you have never been oppressed? You have no idea what that looks or feels like, and you build a theology around something that you cannot possibly know while you exclude voices of people who could help you work through that. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking at a statement like this of people who cannot see it. They do not see it and are willfully attempting not to see it. Mm-hmm. They're not Israel. They're not Israel. They are the Egyptian slave owners. They are the Babylonians. They are the Romans. They are the people with the chariots. These are not people who can understand what that's like. Mm-mm. And so that's why in James Cone's book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree, mm-hmm. you see a picture of a theology that actually says, all right, first of all, let's pull this back a little bit. Jesus was a Jewish person. Mm-hmm. He was Jewish. He was in this oppressed group under the shadow of the Roman Empire.
Right.
That empire, with the leaders, the religious leaders of his day, put him on a tree in front of everyone for everyone's amusement to mock him.
Yeah.
In the same way that Americans, many Christians,
lynched,
put blacks on trees mm-hmm. as a spectacle and an example,
and desecrated their bodies,
mutilated them.
Yeah,
these people don't understand that. They don't understand the connection between the gospel and what is currently going on and historically in this country.
No, because, well, I feel like the understanding escapes that perspective, because to understand that is to also entertain culpability. And most people will not entertain a culpability for a crime that they are dead set against, you know, feeling like they personally have committed. So even the distance that's present in this statement, like, to paraphrase, you can't blame me for what my grandfather did, totally negates the fact that you continue to live on the land that your grandfather stole. You continue to run the company at, you know, X profits, and you continue to promote a payroll that really undercuts your workers, just like your grandfather did. You understand what I'm saying? So you don't get to have a lot of pride in what you call these bootstrap accomplishments, or, you know, I have this because I work hard, when really, when I'm looking at your record, you have been gifted with ill-gotten gains. That's really what it is. So, and we're at a point, I've said this previously, technology has caught up with the narrative, where now in real time we are refuting the narrative. We on people's nerves at this point, right? So if it wasn't a threat, they wouldn't talk about it. If acknowledging that, you know, contrary to this perspective, that, as we say, social justice is the gospel, that means that I'm going at the heart of how you understand how you relate to the God that you created in your mind. The God that you created to further your particular, you know, principles being implemented for a greater number of people. I'm coming at the heart of your psyche, how you see yourself. That's where the resistance comes from.
And it's going to keep coming, because as the more it's attempted to be forgotten, the more we got to remind you.
Mm-hmm.
Because one, we're still here. We're still suffering with this in different ways. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, it's changed.
And we don't intend to continue to suffer silently.
So in order to do that, your first step is to acknowledge that this is a problem. This has been a problem, and it's continuing to be a problem until we actually look at this and say, all right, first of all, we need to agree on the facts.
Mm-hmm.
Black people are still being lynched, except we're not hung on a tree.
Mm-hmm.
We're hung in courtrooms. We're hung in our own homes. As people come in and think they're in their place, supposedly.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
And
somebody lying.
So this is happening.
It's happening.
So I want to look at these Christians who follow Jesus. I want to look at what did Jesus thought about social justice.
All right.
So Jesus. This is a quote from Jesus. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind. Let the oppressed go free. That's Luke chapter 4, verses 18 and 19. He goes on to say that you should treat the least of these like you would treat him, in Matthew 25.
Mm-hmm.
In Matthew 22, he says to love your neighbors as you love yourselves.
Mm-hmm.
For which he previously said in Matthew 7, treat them the way you want to be treated. This isn't every way. This is not just, hey, I saved a seat for you in church.
Hmm.
This is, I stopped voting for someone that was going to harm you.
Ooh, child. Okay.
They brought a woman to Jesus who was caught in adultery. They only brought the woman. They didn't bring the man. Even though the law says both should be stoned, they brought the woman to be stoned, and Jesus saved that woman who was existing in an oppressed
situation.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
That's John chapter 8. There was a sick man at the pool of Bethesda. He healed him. In John chapter 5. Okay, so here's the thing. In the book of Acts, Paul is discussing his credentials, and he studied at the feet of Gamaliel, who was his teacher.
Mm-hmm.
The phrasing "at the feet" is important, because when we see in Luke 10 where Mary and Martha are at the feet of Jesus,
mm-hmm.
we have to understand that in the same way Paul is being taught by his rabbi, Mary and Martha are being taught by their rabbi, mm-hmm. in a culture that prohibited that.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus is elevating them to a position that they would not get, because he understands that we need to write this inequality here.
All right.
Okay. That's in Luke 10. All right. Jesus talked to the Samaritan woman at the well. Well, that one, he was kind of thirsty. The Samaritans are a different type of people. I'll talk about them later. All right. Mm-hmm. So it was a leper. The Sermon on the Mount, after he came down off the Sermon on the Mount, he healed this leper in Luke chapter 5. He healed the Roman centurion's servant in Matthew chapter 8, which queer theologians argue that Roman centurion's servant was more than his servant. Mm. It was someone that he loved because mm-hmm. of the way that he came to Jesus. And they talk about how this Roman centurion who would not bow to a Jew, would not humble himself to a Jew, went to this person and pleaded on behalf of this servant that he loved, that he right. claimed that he loved. And the Matthew version says he wouldn't let Jesus go until he was very persistent about this. So this is not what Roman centurions do. They could be killed for that. So I'm looking at those examples, which are a few of many, and I see Jesus elevating women to a position that they should have. Mm-hmm. I see Jesus providing Galilean health care.
I was about to say, he did not ask for a copay.
I see Jesus, you know, arguably or debatably.
It was a pre-existing condition.
Making a same-sex relationship whole. I see lots of examples where Jesus is chiefly concerned with social justice. Now, mm-hmm. Jesus could be in the temple just spending all his time there, or he could be cozying up to
Pilate. The power structure.
Yeah, he could be doing all that like the mm-hmm. Sadducees and the Pharisees would do. But Jesus was not there.
He would not have been remarkable if he was immediately a part of the authority structure of the day. It would not. We wouldn't even have a New Testament if he was like, Pilate, that's my homeboy. Let me just do everything that he said. Oh, you don't want me walking around? You don't want me performing these miracles? You know what? I'm gonna go sit down. That's just not even his personality. So, or that's not the personality that's put forth in the word. I just feel like there is a cognitive dissonance, though, because to talk about westernized Christianity is to talk about a religion that is born in the Middle East and Europeanized and spread all over the world. I mean, that's history. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we know that whomever survives the battles or whomever controls the pen gets to tell the story. Mm-hmm. So when you look at colonial history, when you look at pre-colonial history and you see the amount of energy that went into destroying ancient writings, into destroying books, into destroying images, you destroy things not so that they'll go away forever, but so that you can replace them, mm-hmm. right? So we still have not gotten to a point where we can reconcile what the word says about Jesus and his appearance versus how that image has been portrayed all over the world. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is psychologically, a lot of people cannot handle it because you are going at the heart of what has been called a white savior complex. This thing is not going to go right until white people come and save you. Mm-hmm. This is something that they've told themselves that powers, and I'm not saying every individual white person. I'm saying that within the power structures that are supported by the major pillars of supremacy, one of the key elements within them is that nothing's going to go right until something white and male is leading it and makes it happen. Mm-hmm. Okay. So even when you talk about manifest destiny, which was an ideal that was bought into by a post-colonial American government who said, how big is big? Right. They justified the mowing over of the land and the eradication of whatever was there because they had said if God didn't want it that way, then we wouldn't have the technology to make it happen. What was the technology? Guns.
And if you some people would say, oh, of course, that's not me. I'm not like that. It doesn't have to be a white male in leadership. Well, how many times have you willingly put yourself in a position to be led by a woman or a person of color or whatever? And that's your choice.
I mean, even currently, politically, we are in a situation right now because a lot of people psychologically threw off this idea of an African-American leader
Hated it so much they couldn't stand it. It was like, put anybody up there next.
Because it just irritated them. And what and the current person really resonated with people, because he was like, if he can do it, I know I can do it. That is bullshit. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, okay. I'm just so thankful that it's not that way.
So we talked about how ridiculous it is to try to cast yourself in the role of Israel without a lens of oppression. Mm-hmm. The other person that people like to cast themselves in is the role of Jesus. And we're looking at some of the stuff that Jesus did. I don't know that you got to ask yourself, am I acting like Jesus acted in terms of who All I right. treat and how I treat them? But let's talk about that time when Jesus was racist. Maybe we can find something.
That one time at band camp. Maybe,
yeah. So, all right, I'm going to have to talk about some scripture here just because
somebody's
saying this is an outlandish statement. Jesus is perfect. Jesus has never happened. So let's open the word up. Boom, boom, ba-doom. Matthew chapter 10, verses 5 and 6. These 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions: go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So the Samaritans were a group that inhabited the north of Israel, where it used to belong to the tribe. Israel was divided into 12 tribes, and one of the tribes was the tribe of Ephraim. Mm-hmm. And they were pushed out of that area. Some Israelites remained, but the people who came in, it was people from all over, and they brought their gods with them. And so they intermarried with the remaining Israelites. And so the Samaritans, you think of them as this mixed race of people who they worshiped Yahweh and other gods, and they mixed things together. It's kind of like, it's just a hodgepodge of people and cultures and religions. And so the rest of the group, the rest of the tribes would look at the Samaritans like they were lesser. It was a form of racism, because they were not really, mm-hmm. they weren't pure Israel, whatever. So Jesus now is telling the disciples, don't go into the Gentiles. Don't go to the Samaritans. Just stick to Israel. Okay. So let's look. That's not really, we can argue. Maybe that's not so racist. Maybe just had a preference, whatever. Okay. So a little bit later, Matthew chapter 15, starting in verse 22. Just then, a Canaanite, or more accurately, the Syrophoenician woman from that region came out and started shouting, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is tormented by a demon." But he did not answer her at all. Okay. And his disciples came up, urging him, "Send her away, for she keeps shouting at us." Okay, so that's kind of odd, Jesus. She came up to him, different race.
Looking for help.
He ignored her.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, he just told the disciples, don't deal with these people. Mm-hmm. Stick to these people. She comes up, not one of those people they were instructed to go to, and he ignores her. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's not a good look for Jesus.
Nope.
I mean, that's not the Jesus that we would expect. Okay. So the disciples said, send her away. She keeps shouting at us. He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." That's the same thing he said before. But now he's facing someone who actually needs help. Her daughter needs a healing. Jesus heals. This is what he does. He's out there healing people. He's just not healing this person. After he ignored her, she kept being persistent. He's like, "No, I'm not here for you." That's kind of wild, Jesus. I don't know if I can go with you on that one. Okay, so but she came and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, help me." Now, this is where Jesus is going to turn it around, because this is somebody that knows who Jesus is, and mm-hmm. it's a simple cry. "Lord, help me." Mm-hmm. I've prayed that prayer. We've all
Many
prayed that
times.
Prayer. "Lord, help me."
Mm-hmm.
So Jesus takes care of that. He says, he answered, "It is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." What the fuck, Jesus? How are you going to? Okay, so dogs in this culture Okay, so dogs not like our dogs now. Right. These dogs are different. Like they eat meat. They eat. They hang out. Like nobody's. They're not pets.
They're feral.
They're feral dogs. Mm-hmm. They're out eating whatever they could find. They're eating dead things. They're eating. But you do not want to be in the company of a dog.
Mm-hmm.
So when Jesus says it is not fair to take the children's food, and children in this case he means the children of Israel,
mm-hmm.
food, and throw it to the dogs, which is this person. This is a high insult. To
right.
this woman.
Right.
Who is asking Jesus for help.
For his help.
The reason why he's insulting her is because he's making it clear the way he sees her. She is not like us.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't get this. I'm only here for my people.
Mm.
She said, "Yes, Lord. Yet, even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." This woman had tremendous faith to keep going after all. See, this is how much she wanted that daughter healed.
Mm-hmm. Like
she knew this was her shot. This is it. If he says no, she has to keep going. So he ignored her. She kept going. He said, "Nah, I'm not here for you." She kept going. He insulted her. That doesn't matter. She kept going and said, "Yeah, I'll take whatever you give me. Whatever crumbs you drop, I that's good enough."
Mm-hmm.
Then Jesus answered her, "Woman, great is your faith. Let it be done for you as you wish." And her daughter was healed instantly. Will Gaffney contends that after this, Jesus' ministry was not the same.
Mm-hmm.
So after the denials, the refusals, the insults, she persisted. She showed her faith and he healed her daughter. White American Christians, you can change.
Mm-hmm.
You've denied, you've ignored.
Yeah.
You've insulted.
Ugh.
But if we're following Jesus and his example, let's do it all the way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you're going to ignore all of the other stuff that he did, you want to cast yourself as Jesus, but you don't want to act like Jesus. Jesus was complex like others, mm-hmm. like us.
Like us.
He didn't get it right this time.
Nope.
And I know that kicks your theology in the nuts, but he didn't get it right this time. Jesus was racist. He was blatantly racist to this woman right here.
Mm-hmm.
But she stayed with it. And eventually he saw the error in
his own way.
And it says instantly she was healed. We got to get to that point because we're not stopping.
Nope.
You can insult us. You can ignore us.
I mean, you've done it. You've done it. Or it has been done. But these systems are under attack, and they're under a righteous attack because they need to fall. Period.
So we're going to get there together. We're going to keep shouting at you. You're getting it wrong, but we're going to keep shouting at you because that's what we're going to do. We're trying to get healed together.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of Jesus' ministry, after he died and he rose, he instructed disciples something different. He said, "Go to all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost." That aperture was opened up mm-hmm. wider than it was. It wasn't no longer just mm-hmm. the house of Israel. This was everyone.
Yeah.
And so you see what the gospel does after that. That social justice gospel that Jesus took, that he lived, even though he believed he wasn't for everyone, that changed.
Right.
And we can change. We can be better. So I mentioned the book before, and I highly recommend it. James Cone, The Cross and the Lynching Tree. He tells a story about when he was a child in Alabama, and he would wait by the window for his father to come home because they were lynching blacks around this time.
Mm-hmm.
And he would just wait, and his dad would come home on time. He would run to his dad and give him a hug. And anytime his father was late,
he was stressed.
Beyond stressed.
Yeah.
That trauma is enormous.
Yeah.
Because he thought that people had captured his dad and lynched him or put him on a tree, mm-hmm. maybe stripped away his dignity, maybe mutilated his body, and he would just be hanging there until someone that loved him came to get him down.
Oh my God.
That's in the mind of a child as he's waiting for his father. The lasting impacts of that trauma, imagine what that's like. Like, what type of person does that child become?
Mm-hmm.
Now, we got some children who worry about what's for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
But other kids are worrying about if their parents are getting stopped at a traffic stop right. on their way home.
Or will I ever see them again?
Or if someone's going to run up in my house, like Baldwin Shim Jane. Mm-hmm. Like, this is real for a lot of people. Yeah. That trauma is so visceral. We need to take care of each other. We need to make sure that the gospel that we live and breathe and talk about is that gospel of the oppressed, because that's what it is.
Yeah.
Jesus is out of this oppressed community. He's taking care of oppressed people. He's making sure that we all be better. So, lynchings still occur in America. Hmm. People are still suffering on this cross in America. And if you can't recognize the connection and understand how the gospel of Jesus Christ is primarily a gospel of social justice, then you are not fit to lead. Hmm. So, to Mr. MacArthur and the 7,000 people who signed that, we're going to keep shouting. For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.